Okay. Welcome, everyone, to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is January 11th, 2018. Happy New Year. We are going to have some brief presentations from representatives who have bills that are, bills that are likely to come to this committee. We don't know that for sure, but I think there are some really exciting bills that we'll be looking at, so I'm hoping they do come to this committee. And we're going to start off with Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Kinigheyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, and colleagues. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. For the record, I'm Pam Marsh. I'm the House Representative for District 5, which is way on the other end of the state, Southern Jackson County, Ashland, Medford, Jacksonville, and the Applegate. So I am so glad to be here with you today to preview a bill that we hope will come in front of your committee in a few weeks. It's called the Home Wrap Project. WRAP is an acronym. It stands for Weatherization Retrofit Affordability Program. Now, this bill took a somewhat unconventional path to get to this committee, and I want to spend just a few minutes talking about its derivation. Some of you will remember at the end of last session that the residential energy tax credit was not renewed, which meant that the programs that were supported by that RETC, energy efficiency, solar, no longer had a source of support. So at the end of the session, I spent a lot of time doing some due diligence, talking to people in the industry, trying to understand three things, really. One, what are the flaws in the RETC that really were a problem? Secondly, what were the needs from the industry for support so that it would remain robust and vital? And third, and this is really the most important piece, how that program could be best restructured to serve Oregonians across the state. After many thoughtful conversations and some out-of-the-box thinking, we realized that we were really looking at a program that could, in effect, help to address the state's housing crisis through targeted investment aimed at the existing housing stock. We can and we need to build more housing, absolutely. But we also need to invest in the thousands of homes and apartments across the state that, with some upgrades, could provide energy-efficient, affordable, and comfortable homes for years to come. So the Home Wrap program was really the results of those conversations. So in short, let me just summarize what the program would do. Wrap provides a financial incentive to homeowners and to nonprofit affordable landlords who install energy efficiency and/or renewable projects on site. The incentive is calculated based on the energy saved or produced by the project. Low and moderate individuals or families will receive a higher incentive to make those projects more attractive and more available to those households. The bottom line will be the production of more comfortable homes and reduced utility costs for homeowners and tenants. Projects that would qualify for the incentive include ductless heat pumps, high-efficiency water heaters, high-efficiency furnaces, solar installations, community solar, with the maximum incentive available at set at $4,500. I want to highlight a few components of the WRAP program that I think are particularly innovative and will be of interest to all of you. First of all, note this is not a tax credit. This is a direct incentive. The reason for that is that we really want to make the program and these upgrades available to lower income individuals and households, those who often don't have a significant tax liability. It also allows us to be a much more inclusive, to allow nonprofit landlords to participate in a program who would otherwise not find a tax credit to be any kind of particular incentive. Secondly, it does target nonprofit and affordable project landlords with the incentive. Over time, we'd really like to figure out a way to expand this program to private landlords. We know that there are thousands of units out there that are in dire need of upgrades and tenants who are suffering. We need to be able to provide some sort of incentive to those landlords to get them to invest in those units, investments that aren't particularly attractive right now when many landlords are getting high dollar for their rental units. But we couldn't quite figure that out. So this is a toe-in-the-water kind of approach. This is to work with nonprofit landlords, affordable certified landlords with the certifiable affordable projects to figure out how an incentive works and how we can best structure a program that really allows tenants to benefit. And third, And this is really exciting, I think. The bill directs 25% of program funds to Oregon Housing and Community Services for projects that begin to braid funding streams for energy efficiency and basic upgrades. We know that traditionally those funding sources have been siloed. We've had weatherization in one pot. We've had basic habitability funding in another pot. Very often those projects are even administered by different levels of government. We think over time we need to figure out a way to bring together different funding streams so that we can start in the state to really do whole home renovation. So if you're going in and you're installing a ductless heat pump, you can also take care of the toilet that's falling through the floor in the bathroom, and maybe at the same time you can strap that water heater to the wall. So the 25% is really intended to be a pilot program to see how we can, again, pair basic habitability funding with weatherization energy efficiency upgrades. And there is a special carve-out within that 25% for manufactured homes, because we know manufactured homes are a particular problem for energy upgrades. The program would also allow us to invest that money in and simply trading out the manufactured home, because many times homes are in such disrepair that it doesn't make sense to try to work on them. Replacement is a much better option. So there are some very exciting pilot programs within there. Finally, let me say a word about the funding that we're asking for. Obviously, because this is not a tax credit, it would require funding. We've asked for $18 million because we believe that's what the industry needs to stay vital. We understand that this is a big ask in a year without a lot of funding available, and so we're prepared to adjust that number. But we wanted to be clear about what we think the ideal funding would be with the bill's objectives in mind. So that's a wrap. How many times will I say that? But I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with all of you.
Great. Yes, questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Marsh, what do you think the minimum starting amount would be that would work?
Well, we haven't really gone there. I think that clearly there are some elements of this program that we would love to pilot, and we would make work even with a smaller pot of funding. The challenge becomes really we have dual purposes, of course. We're investing in homeowners. We're investing in tenant spaces. We're trying to do this 25% of braided funding. We're also trying to have enough business available to the energy efficiency and the solar communities to keep them robust over the next few years, because we know these industries are exceptionally important to our housing stock over time. So we'd be willing to I will not say that we've chosen I can pinpoint a minimum allocation, but we would be willing to work with whatever is available.
Follow up. Thank you. So if you were funding wise, if you ended up scaling it back to a pilot level type funding, mm-hmm. would you be thinking a geographical area as a pilot, or would you just try to pilot certain portions of the project?
That's an interesting question. We haven't thought geographical. We could certainly put some effort into that if that was of interest. We would probably look at the program elements. Over time, there are many things that we're piloting here that we'd like to do and roll out in a much bigger way in the years to come. Braiding those funding streams is a really important part. I think the landlord part is a really essential part. So I think we'd have to look at, depending on the funding level, what was realistic to actually, what pieces of this program we could have, we could still maintain it at a reasonable level and figure out how to scale back.
Okay. Two comments just quickly as we start this meeting, one on process, one on your particular bill. We're doing a preview of bills that we think may come to our committee, and I've asked people to put their LC since we won't have an opportunity to see the bills actually until they get formally introduced. But you do have an opportunity to read more about these bills, because everyone who's going to be presenting today already has their bill, or will have by the end of the day, their LC on OLIS. So you'll have an opportunity to be able to review it, give feedback. On your particular bill, you, I just wanted to say that there's a really good tie-in to a bill that we passed out of this committee last year unanimously and had bipartisan sponsorship from this, chief sponsorship from this committee, and it was on the home repair and weatherization program that the community action agencies do. So right now, community action agencies statewide spend about $2 million on that program that they use from CDBG funds. But they have to turn down so many people. I think the figure was 14 requests to one that is actually granted. And so we had a bill that passed out of this committee, and it was for $10 million just for the weatherization and repair part. That did not make it through last year. But you have elements of that wrapped up into this bill. And I think the idea of doing some, you know, the solar, installing solar and having weatherization along with repairs when there's already work being done on a house makes a lot of sense. So excited to see this, and I invite you all to look at the LCs online when you have a chance. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. We certainly appreciate your feedback if you have specific comments.
Great, thank you. All right, Representative McKeon.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, my name is Katty McEwen. I represent House District 9. Chair Kenny Geyer, it's a delight to be here again today, and members of the committee, to follow up on a bill that came through the last session that was a omnibus bill, a large piece of complicated work dealing with memory care, long-term care facilities. So this is just a small piece of finish-up work to that that long, complex bill that we brought last session. LC 110, I bring for your consideration. As some of you may recall, when we passed House Bill 3359, one of the things that we did not quite complete was a piece on administrative licensing. Nursing facilities have a licensing board, and we want to extend that to memory care facilities and assisted living facilities. So that's what this bill does. When the regular session adjourned, our stakeholder group stayed together and continued to work on this piece as called out in 3359, that we continue this work. So that's what this piece does. The Oregon Nursing Home Administrative Board will be expanded, and it will offer an opportunity for these other facilities to be considered under that licensing board. We're planning to expand that in LC 110 and outlining the standards for memory care and for assisted living facilities. We've taken the current standards for nursing homes and just adapted them in this process to cover those other two types of facilities. And it's an appropriate adaptation for facilities that right now that don't have oversight. And we think it's very important that we bring them under the umbrella of that oversight. We've been working with the Oregon Health Licensing Office in this process as a stakeholder group. The Department of Human Services has been involved in this process as a continuation of 3359. Oregon Healthcare Association is part of the work that we're doing, along with the Governor's Ombudsman's Office, who are determining what the requirements will be. And it's where it's creating a provision for existing administrators. One of the things we have are a number of hundred of administrators that are already doing this work in assisted living facilities and memory care facilities, and we're working to a long ramp-up period where they'll have an opportunity to come into compliance as a licensed administrator, as well as creating the framework for new administrators coming in. So that's the gist of what we're doing. It's a relatively small piece of work compared with what we did last time, but it kind of puts a bow on all the work that we did in 2017 with 3359. We think it's very important as these administrators have oversight, and so we'll be bringing this to you when the session opens, and LC 110 will be, like you said, on OLIS later today, and you'll have a chance to take a look at it. Our stakeholder group will be meeting again between now and the time the session starts to fine-tune. I'm assuming you'll be seeing an amendment with some details that are going to fine-tune this piece of work, but we're looking forward to presenting it to you to finish up the good work that was done in 2017.
That's great, and I think many of you actually signed on to that bill last year, and the other advantage of hearing about some of these bills is before they actually get formally introduced, if anyone would like to sign on to anything that you hear today, please contact the chief sponsor.
Please do, and Madam Chair, I appreciate your good work on this as well. This has been a very collaborative piece of work, and we'll look forward to bringing it to you shortly. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So next, we've got a couple people who are right here on the dais. You're welcome to present from here or to come up. Representative Nierman.
Thank you. There you go. Members of the committee, Madam Chair, for the record, I'm State Representative Mike Nierman from House District 23. So the bill that I have, I think it's LC 63. Anyway, it's a bill to address kind of a small problem. It's kind of a pickle that a few parents get in with DHS. When you have, I'll just kind of make up a case here. If let's say you have a child who has a serious illness and there's a remedy for it, but the remedy only has maybe a small chance of success. And so the parents have two options. One of them is to apply the remedy to their child, in which and the remedy may be severe. Let's say it's like chemo or something like that. And so they put themselves in a position of having DHS say that because you're applying this remedy to your child, that's child abuse, and then they DHS will intervene. The on the flip side of the coin, if they don't apply the remedy, DHS might be put in a position where they say that this is child abuse and that they intervene, so that the parents are put in a pickle here. And what this bill does is just makes it clear that if parents are following medical advice, that they're not, that that's not child abuse. And so it doesn't get into any of the kind of maybe related things of vaccines or some of those kinds of things. It just steers clear of that. But it's to try to resolve this situation. It's this. It's modeled after a bill that passed in Massachusetts to solve the same problem. And so I hope to have your support for that.
Great. Any questions?
I do. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mike, interesting concept. I'm just curious, isn't there already some kind of policy within Department of Human Services that kind of describes and dictates this right now for how they would respond if medical involvement is there?
So not that I know of, and I think that legislative counsel would have tipped me off if there was. I hope they would. I don't know. And it's it was brought to me by some constituents who claimed that that this was a issue. It's obviously not very common, but does come up.
Just follow up. Did you get a chance to talk with Marilyn Jones? She's the new director of the child welfare.
No, I didn't, and I probably should do that before the session starts.
Very good. Thanks.
Great. Any other questions? Thank you, Representative Nierman. Representative Peluso, ready.
Good morning, everybody. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso. I represent House District 50, the great city of Gresham, and always a pleasure to be here to talk about TANF. So my bill is actually a conversation starter or a conversation continuer. You know, we started with this TANF program or the assets. We wanted to apply to the TANF program in 2015 with House Bill 3535, 2017 with House Bill 2347, and I'm here to talk about the yet-to-be given a bill, but LC9. So it is around TANF, and it is, again, a conversation starter is our goal here today. So it requires the Department of Human Services to use savings in temporary assistance for needy families program to increase amount of cash grants. So again, it's really a very simplistic bill in that regard. So beginning in July 1 of 2018, if policy changes made by the Department of Human Services in the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families programs and improvement in the economy of this state or other factors results in savings in the program, the department shall use the savings to increase the amount of cash grants provided through the program up to an amount equal to the value of the grants in 1996, adjusted to reflect increases in the United States City Average Consumer Price Index. Again, want to keep TANF growing, want to keep TANF going, and just looking for that pathway to make that happen.
Okay. Any questions on that? I think what's quite amazing is that the amount of the monthly benefit has stayed the same since 1996.
Yeah. Yes.
That's stunning.
Mm-hmm. Really 412. Stunning.
Is it 412?
Yes.
That's how much it is?
Yes.
Wow. Quite stunning. Thank you so much
for
continuing the conversation. All right. So we're going to take a little break in hearing from member bills right now because of timing. We've got Lilia Tenenti here, who I know has to testify in the next committee over. And we wanted an opportunity to hear about some of the DHS programs and providers, private providers in the IDD community. In the September and November, we had an opportunity because of Marilyn Jones becoming the new child welfare director. We were able to hear a little bit more about that side of DHS. We've heard certainly quite a bit from Housing and Community Services. So we're not doing any overall agency presentation this time. It's really focusing on the bills that are coming up. But we did want to carve out some time for the intellectual and developmental disability community because they really didn't get much of a chance in the fall to catch us up with what's happening. So would love it if Director Tenenti and Leslie Sutton and Diana Hansen, if you could all come together, because there may be questions that you can all be answering together, if you'd all come up.
Good morning, Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lilia Tenenti. I'm the Director for the Office of Developmental Disability Services.
My name is Leslie Sutton. I'm the Policy Director for the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities.
My name is Diana Hansen.
I am the Director of the Central Oregon Disability Support Network and a Program Coordinator for FACT Oregon. My husband and I have three children, and our youngest child receives developmental disability services.
Thank you for coming all the way from Central Oregon and being here this early. Yeah.
Good morning, members of the committee. I'll just do a quick overview of where things stand for ODDS and the programs for children and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And then I'll really dive a little deeper on one specific issue that I think is of utmost concern and has raised a lot of questions from legislators and others over the course of the last several legislative days. To start with, the Office of Developmental Disability Services provides in-home residential employment, a number of different services for children and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Over the course of the last now three biennia, we have seen significant budget growth in the DD program area. That's primarily been caused by a legislative direction in 2013 to move to what is called the Community First Choice Option, or in our shorthand, K-Plan. The K-Plan was a federal option made available through the Affordable Care Act that allowed states to, if they chose to use that particular authority, allowed states to get an additional 6% federal match on dollars that were spent on the types of services that I talked about, in-home services primarily. What's happened over the course of time since that was implemented within the DD program is that in order to meet the federal requirements for getting that additional 6%, we had to make significant program changes that have driven up our budget. One of them was ultimately a very good change and one of the things that we've seen a lot of benefit from, which is that we are now serving more children in in-home with in-home services, children who live with their families, children who prior to this change ultimately had very little resource from the state available to them, and who, in order to get resource from the state, get supports, those families, the child really had to go into crisis. There had to be some kind of situation where the child kind of moved up in terms of level of need, and then that's what brought them, would bring them into services in the DD program prior to the K plan. At that point, we served, less than 700, around 700 children in a variety of kids residential programs and children in-home services intensive programs. Now we serve well above that with through the K plan, and we're seeing that caseload continue to grow. I would say, though, based on the data that we've looked at, and this is a little bit confusing to say, so I'll work on saying it correctly, but basically, while we are seeing continued increases in caseload growth for children, the percentage of that increase is decreasing. So we're seeing decreases in our increasing growth in caseload. Mm-hmm. And we expected that. That's what we thought would occur, because basically what happened when the K plan started was we had a lot of what you call pent-up demand. Kids and families who didn't have access to anything who suddenly were able to access services coming through the door. And so we expected over time, we had a research institute look at Oregon's population in comparison to California and Arizona, two states that also run similar wide door programs. And we project that early, mid-2019, I won't say early anymore, but mid-2019, that our children's caseload growth will just ultimately level off. It won't continue to increase at the levels it's been increasing over the last couple of biennia. And we're starting to see that with the statement I made earlier in terms of increased caseload growth for kids. The other budget driver for us in the context of the K plan is that prior to the K plan, we had a very small amount of funding available for adults who lived with their families or lived independently to access services. It was capped through the Medicaid authority that we were using at that time, the dollar amount. And so with the K, though, we had to remove that cap, and we provided services then based on an assessment. And so people who had been prior to that making do, working with natural supports, relying heavily on families, to be honest about it, and other things, were suddenly able to access much more paid Medicaid support. So we have seen our budget grow significantly over the past several biennia, both because of caseload growth for children and because of increased costs per case, especially around our adult in-home service population. So all of these factors have led to very intense discussions around the sustainability of the ODDS budget in the future, not just now, but also in the future. When we look at what the future might hold, we don't know. All we know for sure is that from the perspective of a state budget, seeing this significant growth continue at this level, it won't. Ultimately, it puts all of our services and everyone we serve at risk. So we have, over the course of the last couple of biennium, worked hard with our stakeholders. We've worked hard with legislators to try to identify things that we can do to try to contain our growth, try to bend our cost curve, if you will, level it out. And ultimately, we have put a lot of ideas on the table. We've had a lot of discussions, and for various reasons, ultimately, we don't get too far in a lot of those discussions. And so we did, though, with this last biennia, have some very directed cuts for the DD program. Probably one of the most significant is we eliminated the regional programs. This was funding for contracted staff to help us funnel and triage, if you will, people who needed residential placement throughout the state. We've now absorbed that work within the office and the policy staff at ODDS, but also within our community partners, our community developmental disability programs, and our brokerages. And we owe a debt of gratitude to those programs for helping us absorb this work without any additional funding. We had our workload model, the funding for our field staff, CDDPs, and brokerages. It was not funded at the level that we were hopeful for based on the an updated workload model and projections of caseload growth. So that was another significant reduction we took in our program. And so we had some directed cuts along those lines. The biggest thing, though, that I would say that came through in our budget for this biennia was direction to make a $12 million general fund generic reduction. Basically, what that said to us as the program and to legislators was, we've looked at the options you presented. We're not sure which ones of these will work or how this will work. So you take, you go back to your stakeholders, you go back, you find $12 million to reduce, and then you come and report back to us on how that's going and what you're doing. I say as a result of that, that's why I've got a conflict. I'll be testifying in Joint Ways and Means right after this, because I'm going back every legislative day is to present on what we've done, what we're proposing to do, just to keep everybody updated, and ultimately to engage with legislators in discussions about the difficult decisions that we need to make. So that, I would qualify that as the big picture overview of what's been happening in ODDS. In regard to the $12 million generic reduction, what I will be sharing with the legislature in the next committee and what I submitted in our report is that we have found about $1.3 million in general fund savings from a couple of contracts that were increased over time as part of CSL, but we've been maintaining the amount of funding that we've been spending on them. So we're offering that money to go toward the $12 million general fund generic reduction. If that's accepted, as we hope it will be, then that brings our liability. And I'm doing quick math down to, I think, $10.7 million instead of $12 million. So then we still have to find an additional $10 million to continue to work toward that $12 million generic reduction. One of the things that occurred over the last biennium was we were encouraged, and we did talk with OHA and with CMS many times, and we continue those discussions, frankly, with CMS and OHA about options that are on the table for us to make tough decisions that ultimately reduce our budget and result in savings for the state. The KA has a lot of regulations that go with it that make a lot of the decisions that states would normally use in these type of situations very difficult. We also have very involved legal, I would say, advocacy around any decisions that we make in the DD program. And in fact, last year we had moved forward with working with stakeholders on a particular reduction to in-home services that's now been stopped ultimately due to a lawsuit. We agreed to a preliminary injunction, and so we're working through what our next iteration of that will be with our stakeholders and with the plaintiffs, or with the attorneys representing plaintiffs, Disability Rights Oregon. All of that is to say that we don't have, again, that's just an example of, we don't have a lot of options in front of us at this point. So what we, in talking to CMS last year, what we have proposed and what we are working to do is change the structure of our Medicaid waiver. These are 1915, I'm going to go a little bureaucratic. These are 1915C waivers as opposed to the K-plan. People use the C waiver oftentimes to access K-plan services, while people can also just access K-plan directly. The C waivers include employment services that aren't on the K-plan and some other key things. We're going to change the structure of our waivers and create an adult waiver and a children's waiver. This is the creation of a children's waiver has been a policy discussion within the ODDS and DD community for a long time. Even outside of budget discussions, there are good policy reasons to do it. It gives us the potential in the future to craft services in the waiver specifically for children. So there are good reasons for doing it overall. In this moment, the other reason that we're looking at doing this is because it allows us to, using the 1915C authority, cap the number of children that we have coming into services. And so, unlike today, where anyone, any child with a parent whose income is above or below Medicaid eligibility, it doesn't really matter, they can come into services using either directly the K or the 1915C. What we're going to do is ask CMS for authority or permission to cap the number of kids that come into the program through the 1915C. What that will mean, we're looking at a July 1st implementation date for that. That will all depend on when we get the application to CMS and how long it takes them to review it and how long our back and forth goes before they finalize it. What that would do is, as of July 1st, children whose parents were Medicaid eligible, financially eligible, their parents or guardians, they would continue to access all of our in-home services and other services, including residential services. But children whose parents were making above the Medicaid eligibility requirement would go onto a waiting list. And we would shift back to some extent to a system that put kids who were not in crisis but just needed a little bit of support, we would have them wait on a waiting list until we had funding available through attrition and other things to move them into in-home services. The other point on this I will say is for children, even whose parents make above the Medicaid eligibility requirements, if they're in crisis, if they need residential placement, that would be foster care or kids' residential group homes, once they're out of the home, their income is counted alone, and so they would still be able to access services. So the population of families and children that this would primarily impact is those families who are ultimately don't have a child in crisis, don't have a crisis situation, who needs something to help them potentially maintain not being in crisis, but who would then go onto a waiting list for services until we had funding available to move them in. A couple of key points on this. As of the date that this goes into effect, as of the date CMS approves it, people who are currently in the program, even children who are in-home services whose parents are above the Medicaid eligibility financial requirement, they would continue to be able to access services. This wouldn't have an effect on kids who are currently in or would be in by the date that that happened. The impact on this would be kids trying to access those services after the date, the implementation date. We estimate by doing this that we went back and looked at pre-K plan estimates on the number of children who are coming into residential services, which is higher than what it's been under the K plan as a result of, we think, in-home services for K plan kids. We estimate that our savings for the rest of this biennium, if we go into effect July 1st of this year, is about $300,000 general fund, and over the course of the next full biennium is about $2.7 million general fund. So we just start to see the savings this biennium, but then it grows, obviously, through the next full biennium. So that has been a very difficult discussion. I will be perfectly direct and honest and say it's inconsistent with the vision of the DD system and with the work that we've done with our stakeholders to this point to identify our values and what we want for the future of the system. However, given where we're at with the budget, this is the direction that we're at this point moving in for budget reasons, frankly, more than anything else.
Okay. One quick question, and then because they may also have some...
So with the savings, how many, because if it's only going forward, we're grandfathering in people who would currently on, it's only new people who would be applying, how many children do we estimate would not receive benefits that would under the current system?
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Representative Stark, our estimates on that, and I'm going to flip quickly because I have a number in my head and I don't want to say the wrong number. We estimate that going onto the waiting list, we would have 32 children per month would go onto the waiting list, which is about 35% of the total number of kids we have coming in right now. So of the kids we have coming in right now, two-thirds have come from families who meet Medicaid financial eligibility requirements, one-third do not, and it would be the one-third, about 35 kids per month that would go onto the waiting list.
So how much would that save?
Once we start this, if assuming it's July 1st, it's $300,000 general fund for this biennium, and then about $2.7 million general fund for the next biennium. Obviously, if we miss our time frame for July 1st due to CMS issues, going back and forth, whatever that might look like, the $300,000 becomes less with each month that passes.
Okay, let's have the other presentations, and then we'll open it up for more questions.
Thank you. Again, my name is Leslie Sutton. I'm the Policy Director for the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, and my job here today is to give you kind of an overview from the stakeholder community and then hand it over to Diana to talk about specific family impact. So bear with me as I kind of take you in a high-level moment here, and then we'll pass it off momentarily. So, again, the council takes direction from people experiencing intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families as we create policy change that can bring communities and families together. We know that Oregon is strongest when all people, no matter what age they are, have supports to be successful, and that includes raising children at home. And we're not alone in these views. In 2013, the legislature did enact values in Oregon law that specifically apply to the DD system, that have the system prioritize services that support community integration, that support self-determination, and that support families to raise their children experiencing developmental disabilities at home. We do applaud the DD program and Lilia herself for strong leadership and transparency in these changes. She has been going around to a lot of stakeholder groups and talking with a lot of us about these potential waiver changes and what they mean for folks, and has been very responsive in data requests to the extent that they can provide data as well. So we do appreciate her leadership and transparency in this. However, we believe that eligibility changes that result in a wait list and then phase two, which Lilia didn't quite get into, would talk about no longer allowing kids whose parents have an income above the Medicaid threshold to receive DD services. So there is a phase two in this, if needed, where we would essentially take those children whose families earn over the Medicaid limit out of the DD system. So that is causing us great concern when you look at the values that are in Oregon law. We don't believe that matches at all. So we really do think that these proposed changes that are stemming from the 2017 legislature, which Lilia did go into in great detail, around the $12 million, is really of concern to us. This reduction, she did mention, too, is the $12 million is not the only reduction the program was asked to take. It's also asked to take about $30 million in other reductions. And when you talk about federal match, that comes to about $54 million. Has already come out in the 2017-19 biennium out of the DD system. So having a conversation about a generic $12 million and having it go to something like eligibility, which is potentially removing children from services, is really a philosophical change. If you want to have a conversation about how a program serves people, we believe that should be a conversation with the state and with stakeholders about changing eligibility, and it shouldn't be cloaked in a budget discussion because it confuses things. This is really, if you're going to change eligibility, you're significantly transforming people's lives and transforming people's futures, and we believe that we should have a conversation about that instead of having it couched in pressures of a budget. I will also say that since I mentioned Lilia has been great about going around and meeting with a lot of groups, we did have a conversation in the DD community with providers of adult services, providers of children's services, families with children experiencing developmental disabilities, adults with developmental disabilities, and advocates. You name it, we had a big conversation around what is the social contract in the DD community? What can people expect from services? And really listen to what the community said. And I will say unanimously, people said, do not change eligibility. Do not do it. Unanimously, they said, let's come together and find some sustainability measures that we can bring forward as a group and as a community. But we don't want to push people out of the system because we know that is pushing them into isolation, it's pushing them into crisis, and eventually into potentially higher services. We also have concerns that if you're not going to serve a child and a family when the child is young, that changes the trajectory of their life, and they may be more expensive to support as adults when they will hit the DD system without the kids' waiver complication. So these kinds of traumatic consequences to families, to communities, to children, that's what we were hoping to avoid by putting values like this in Oregon law. And we would hope that a more prudent path would be really to let the caseloads plateau in 2011, allow some sustainability measures to get on the ground and play out. Let's see some changes that happen that requires patience on your part to bear with us in the budget conversation. But we really believe that allowing this time is really important so that children experiencing IDD can have opportunities to access supports and be successful just like anybody else. So thank you so much for your time. I'll hand it over to Diana.
Thank you.
They're way more polished than I am. Bear with me. Chair Kenny Gelser, I'm members of the committee. Again, my name is Diana Hansen, and I come to you today from Sunny Bend. And through both my professional roles, I've had the opportunity to work with hundreds of families across Central and Eastern Oregon, primarily the families that I work with. Through my personal role, I know what it means, you know, to live with these developmental disability services, I'm within our life every day. Sorry. This is
it's all right.
Mm-hmm. Good grief. So DD services provide families with in-home supports, like they've kind of shared, supports such as behavior supports that can prevent or react to different behavior crisis that might be happening, personal support workers, relief care, access to the Oregon Health Plan. Many of these supports cannot be accessed except through the DD service system, and I would say that, you know, they're a critical lifeline that hold many families together. The Oregon Health Plan gives coverage as both primary or secondary form of insurance for children who are eligible. Access to OHP is incredibly important to so many families. Private insurance helps, however. For our family, we were still expending between $15,000 and $30,000 a year for out-of-pocket copays, deductibles, and medical needs that weren't covered through our private insurance. So for us, that's been a game changer alone, just that one piece of this program. And my story is definitely not unique. I hear from families all the time about the extreme medical costs that they have, either, you know, before developmental disability services were available to them or while they're waiting through the eligibility process. I'd like to share just a couple of stories with a couple of families that I've worked closely with to kind of give you an idea of what these services look like for, you know, a couple of different families. For one single mom whose 10-year-old daughter was living in a state residential facility, DD services meant they were able to bring her home and back into her community. They were able to enroll her back into her community school with her peers and her siblings. Once at home, they were able to access personal support workers and a behavior specialist to assist with skills training, some technology to assist with communication for this young girl, and a few home modifications to make the home a safe place for everyone. The mom was also able to access relief care on occasion to, you know, get a break, be able to go to a doctor's appointment or go to her, you know, friend's house, and she would just get a full night's sleep while somebody was at the house helping to care for her daughter so she could, you know, continue on. Sometimes that's all it takes is a little break to keep going. For another family that I work with, DD services meant being able to access behavior supports when they were really at their wit's end. They had no idea what to do. They really didn't know if they were going to be able to keep their child in their home, and they were able to access therapies and medical support that they were not able to afford without the OHP secondary insurance. They were able to have the help of a support worker, so they went out as a family, they were able to give attention to all of their children, not just the one with the highest needs. It really meant for their entire family that they were able to focus on the family as a whole and their future together instead of one crisis after another. for either of those families, having access to DD services was a game changer. Not having access would mean that they probably, well, 99% sure, would not be able to keep their children at home. And that would be a huge loss to both their families and to the communities that these families live in. For our family, DD services meant being able to install a security system in our home. So when we woke up in the middle of the night and our daughter was missing, we would have a heads up. She was leaving the house. We were on a first-name basis with the police departments in Central Oregon for a while because she would just, for whatever reason, in the middle of the night, just take off. So it gave us access to that support, which, thank you. Some of the other things it did, for our family was we were able to access a behavior specialist to help us with strategies around communication that worked for all of us. Instead of her hitting, biting, and running, we were able to put some strategies in place and some tools that could help her communicate those things in a positive way. For the first time in, many years, my husband and I, here we go again.
Okay.
Good grief, sorry.
It's all right. It's
all right. I hate this when this happens.
Oh, it shows how important it is.
We were able to get away for just a night to really just reconnect and relax to better take on the responsibilities that come with having a child who has high needs. Thank you. I honestly don't know, as a family, for us, like, what our life would look like today without the supports that we've received. With Oregon's old DD system, families, were offered much support unless they were in crisis. Like Lily was saying, like, families had to be forced into crisis. Many children, families today still are traumatized by that and what they chose to do or what they felt like they were forced to do by signing, a document saying that they could no longer care for their children. I guess personally for me and all of the families that I work with, I would, urge us to not take a step back. Let's not go back to that. Our old system meant that when kids turned 18, they could access DD services, so adult services were available. They likely needed more support at that time because there weren't the supports for children, and so they were coming into the system at 18. I wonder what kind of adults we would have today if all of those adults were supported as children, like the children are currently being supported under developmental disability services. Effective supports that help a child have a typical life will result in adults with developmental disabilities who are active and engaged in our communities. They're, really able to leverage the integrated supports at that time. So they will be better connected and more likely to find meaningful jobs. They will be engaged in community resources that really decrease the burden on the support of state-funded services. And effective support from the start really changes trajectory for children, and I think we've seen that across systems. Oregon is stronger when people have supports that they need to live and work. For many families, the lifeline supports that allow them to remain a family are these DD services. The threat of losing services or not being able to access services when they really need them or until they're in a crisis situation really has a lot of families, upset and panicked about what that might look like. So thank you for the opportunity to share.
Yeah.
Happy to answer
any
questions.
Thank you so much for sharing your story and story of so many others.
Other questions for this panel? It certainly seems like a Sophie's choice, because what we're saying is we'll protect the kids whose families are Medicaid eligible because of income. We'll protect those that are so severe that they need to have placement outside the home. But my concern would be that this will compel some families who are really struggling to actually not house them in their own home, but house them somewhere else. And then, of course, that's way more expensive care, but I think what you're probably banking on is that a number of people will not do that, and so that's where the savings are. They stay at home, but they don't have the services, and clearly the quality of life is not as good. I mean, I'm guessing that's kind of the Sophie's choice here. So are these decisions that you have impossible choices when you've been asked to cut a certain amount? I hear from the DD community that they would prefer us not to squeeze the pressure and to continue to let some of the other sustainability measures that you've taken take place and allow it to plateau some, but still have a significant commitment. You're making a presentation today. Are these decisions that are going to be made in the February session?
Chair Kinney-Geyer, I think the intent of the budget note that requires me, ODDS, to go back and report every legislative day to the Joint Ways and Means Committee on decisions and options we're looking at are to engage in the exact kind of discussion that we're having right now, and that I can tell you we had in the committee, in the Joint Ways and Means Subcommittee last Ledge Days, and I expect when I go over there now, we'll continue this session. So I think at this point, the pressure that we're seeing, you know, is legitimate. The budget growth in the DD system has been significant over the past several biennia, and we can all agree on the reasons for it, if we're going to try to address it, and again, I go back to the idea or the concept of, you know, making sure that we don't put services and people who are currently served at risk, we have difficult decisions to make. And so we're moving forward with this. We check in on a regular basis. My guess is that we'll continue this discussion not only today but in February legislative session. From my perspective as the director and a responsibility to follow the direction of the legislature on our budget, I can't ignore the fact that we've got to find $12 million somewhere, not in the long term, but by the end of this biennia. So that's where this comes from. It doesn't come from a place of truly wanting to follow the vision of the DD system and do this. It comes from a place of we have tried so many other things and been stopped either through Medicaid regulation because of the K plan and because of the connection of the K plan to the 6%, or because of legal reasons, that I would say the legal issues haven't quote unquote fully stopped everything, but they've definitely paused it for a while, because of concern, the kinds of concerns that are being voiced here about supporting people through a wide door, but maybe only providing a little bit, which becomes a challenge with the K and with legal issues. We're putting every option we can from the ODDS DHS perspective on the table, not because there are any easy answers, there are none, but because if we are to meet the goal of the legislature of reducing our budget by $12 million by the end of this biennium, we've got to start, unfortunately, moving in difficult directions.
Okay. All right.
I could just make one quick comment.
Yes, you may.
We definitely understand Lilia's perspective on that for sure, and as a stakeholder community, we also realize that there are a lot of pressures on Oregon's budget as a whole. However, the revenue forecasts have been up over $150 million since the close of session, and we would hope that perhaps some of Oregon's economic growth can go to take this $12 million off the table. As we know, we expect long-term consequences from making these changes, and not only in families and communities' lives, but also in the match rate that we would receive from the federal government. So we would encourage the legislature to also look at the big picture, and we do recognize there are huge pressures on Oregon's budget, but our economy has been up, and we would hope that that conversation does become part of of your conversation in February. So thank you.
Yeah, Leslie just hit it on the head.
Yeah. Thank you very much. This is very illuminating, and it is something that I think as a policy committee we need to be up on and not just have this discussion in the budget committee. So really appreciate it. Again, really appreciate you coming from so far, sharing your story.
Okay, thank you.
So we're going to return now to presentation of member bills, and we're going to start with Representative Fahey.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. I'm Julie Fahey, the state representative for House District 14, which is West Eugene and Junction City. And I really appreciate you giving me a few minutes to talk about LC 190 today. And I wanted to thank Chair Kenny Geyer for the use of one of her personal bills as the vehicle for this concept. This bill deals with the process for removing discriminatory restrictive covenants from the deeds of real property. So what does that mean? In the deeds of real property, there are often covenants, conditions, and restrictions, which we call CC&Rs, associated with that property. CC&Rs are binding legal obligations written into the deed that stay with the deed into perpetuity. So, for example, I've got a copy of the CC&Rs for my home in West Eugene, and one of the restrictions is that no building shall be located less than 20 feet from the front street line of any lot. So you have to have a setback on your property. However, during the first half of the 20th century, it was common practice to use restrictive covenants to prohibit property from being sold or rented to specific races. So in the CC&Rs of my home, which were written in 1949, there is a restriction that reads, "No member of any race other than the Caucasian race shall use or occupy any building except as domestics in the home of an owner or tenant." So these were written in 1949, but the language is still in the deed as of today. There was a Supreme Court case in 1948 that ruled racially restrictive covenants to be unenforceable, but the practice continued. 20 years later, in 1968, the Fair Housing Act passed. And by the way, it's the 50th anniversary of that bill passing this year. The Fair Housing Act prohibited discrimination of sale, rental, and financing of dwellings based on race, color, national origin, religion, et cetera. This law officially made the use of racially restricted covenants illegal. I think it's important to note that these covenants were not isolated incidences. This practice was widely used in Oregon and across the country, and the Federal Housing Administration actually spurred the growth of these covenants because they recommended their use in their underwriting manual in 1934. The manual recommended that to retain property values, properties should continue to be occupied by the same social and racial classes. It wasn't until 1950 that the FHA stopped encouraging this. These covenants systematically locked out millions of American families from the most common way to accumulate wealth in the 20th century. And the usage of these covenants continues to affect today both the access to affordable housing and the distribution of wealth across Americans' families. Although these restrictive covenants are no longer enforceable or legal, the language still remains in real property titles and deeds across the state of Oregon. These are the actual CC&Rs associated with my property. And if any owner wants to remove these discriminatory covenants from their deed, the current process under Oregon law is cumbersome, it's expensive, and it's lengthy, and it's not particularly accessible to someone who doesn't have a lawyer. You have to file a petition in circuit court and go through a process to notify all of the owners of record of the property via certified proof of service. So I've been working with the DOJ to develop a proposal in LC 190 that would streamline that process for owners to remove that language if they want to. In particular, the proposal changes the requirements for notifying all the owners of record and allows you to use certified mail instead of a more lengthy and cumbersome process. So thank you for letting me have a few minutes to talk about this concept, and stay tuned for more details.
Yes, Representative
Yerman. Good. So this is excellent work, and embarrassing that the 1950s doesn't seem like all that long ago that we would have this stuff go on, and just kind of makes you sick to hear about it. But how do you draw a line around this kind of stuff, which is really abhorrent, and something like, let's say, like I'm just trying to think of an example of maybe some kind of building code or something like that that's maybe not legal anymore or something like that? I can't really think of an example, but do you have a line that's drawn?
Thank you, Rep. Nierman and Chair Kenny-Geyer. So one of the things that we work through with the DOJ is whether or not we could actually take this process out of the court system. So, but because it deals with the deeds to real property, the DOJ really felt like we could not take it out of the court system. We need a judge to look at the language itself and say, yes, this is actually discriminatory according to the laws that we've already passed in the legislature and the federal level. So I think that's part of the line, is that there needs to be this sort of stopgap of a judge actually needs to look at it and say, yes, this is not aligned with our current laws.
Good. I feel like I know it when I see it, but good. Thank you.
And it is limited. This bill is limited to what's racially discriminatory, correct? Not dealing with building codes and other things that for some reason may no longer, like asbestos or something like that. Mm-hmm. This is specific to this. I do think that it sounds like you stumbled upon it when you bought your house and happened to read it, which I told her I thought was amazing. Because I certainly I didn't read the deed when I signed off on my title. But I think that the fact that you discovered this and brought it to us, and it happens to be the 50th anniversary of the Fair Housing Act, is significant. And again, taking these out of deeds doesn't actually do anything substantively, because the federal law trumps what's here. It says you cannot enforce something that actually is racially discriminatory. But these kind of blemishes on our history of racial discrimination, and being able to take that out of ongoing living documents, at least giving people the opportunity to do it if they wish, and streamlining that, is a really important step toward healing.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Fahey, for bringing this forward. Because this is what I do as part of my job, and I review these CC&Rs for my clients to see if they're going to be able to do what they want to do on this property and live, happily. And even though it may seem harmless that, it's not enforceable anymore, the fact that it's there, it kind of brings up scars and digs deep to, hey, am I really welcome in this neighborhood? Am I welcome in this community? And it's some of the things you're working on are related to a bill that I'm going to be working on with the task force, which I'll be speaking about pretty soon. But so I think it's very important, and I do like the opportunity that we can clean up these records, because even though it does not enforceable, it does cause, folks to rethink their, whether they're accepted or wanted in these communities, and or whether they belong in some of these communities and some of the history that's related to that. So thank you very much for this work, and I want to be a co-sponsor on that bill.
Okay. We'll bring it by.
Great. Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
And now we have Representative Brock Smith.
Good morning, Madam Chair, colleagues. Good to see you this morning. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you about LC 60. Hopefully you have it in front of you. If you remember in the 17th session, you supported, and so did this body, House Bill 2377. House Bill 2377 was an incentive for workforce multifamily housing. And it allowed the developers of multifamily housing to negotiate really with the local jurisdiction on what is median household income, and then really provide abatement of the taxes associated with the new assessed value of the property, so that they can lower rents for a portion of the qualified renters. And part of the original bill, and I appreciate the chair's guidance in all of this, is especially the newbie, and I'm not in the realm of housing, only the dire need in my areas across the state. was a residential piece so that we can get folks into, our working families into homes that they can then start building equity in and providing, a core sense of value and also to assist them in their future years as they move forward. And so that is what LC60 does. It has been worked on since we pulled it from the original bill. It provides a incentive to build workforce housing and rather than sell it at market value, sell it at a reduced rate for a qualified buyer. That qualified buyer then, of course, has stipulations, deed restrictions for themselves. It has to be owner-occupied. They can't, if they do sell within 11 years, they have to sell to another qualified buyer. And they get 3% equity per year for that 11 years because we don't want to provide this incentive for these qualified buyers and then them rent them out or flip them. So what it does, what is the incentive to the builder of the homes to sell at a lower rate is a they would get a 50% of the construction cost back as a tax credit. And so it's easy for me to think about it in numbers. So somebody invests $200,000 into a 1,500 square foot, 3-bedroom, 2-bath home. It goes on the market, depending on where you are, let's say for $375,000. The qualified buyer, if they wish to go through this program, would then, let's say, qualify for $275,000. The builder and seller of the home could then get $100,000 back in the tax credit and $75,000, of course, for selling the home. And so it's really meant to do a number of things. It's meant to be an incentive to sell homes for the working families, our teachers. In my district, in my school board, and my school district, I've been a longtime school board member. We are a very small school district and the 8th most impoverished district in the nation, really. And we have a problem with teachers. We get a lot of new teachers that are coming into the education system. And there's no homes for them to rent. A lot of, just in Curry County alone, 33% of the housing stock is owned by people that don't live there. And so they really don't have a place to live. And when they do, at their salary, starting off in the education sector, they really can't afford, the $1,800 a month just for a, 2-bedroom, 1-bath home on the coast. So I think that's indicative everywhere. And one of the things that we know to help this housing crisis that we do have is adding supply. And in adding supply, this provides, I really see it as a pilot project. It caps it at $10 million at the biennium in the tax credit to reinvigorate the construction industry. I don't know, my brother lives in Hillsboro. There's, buildings going up all over the place and multifamily homes, but not a lot of residential properties. And so this could help in those areas. We know we have a trade skill issue with regards to a lot of our construction workers that we need to rejuvenate. This could help do that. We know that in adding supply and these folks that are currently renting these properties that will be taking part in this program and buying, then opens that rental up for lower income families to move into. And it's really a win-win across the state because it doesn't matter. If the people that are going to be able to take advantage of this to start building these homes could build in Gresham or they could build in Ashland or they could build in Corvallis, it really doesn't matter where they build. And so we can look at it as a statewide solution or part of the solution to the problem. So thank you.
Great. Any questions for Representative Rocksmith? Thank you for continuing to work on this idea, bringing innovative ideas to the table. I think we're up for Representative Meek.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs. For the record, Mark Meek, representative for House District 40. And my legislative concept there is for a task force, establishing a task force addressing racial disparities in home ownership. And we spoke earlier about economic development and wealth distribution. And the National Association of Realtors did a study in 2015, and checking the equity or wealth of somebody at the age of 65, and those that owned their home, those that did not own their home, their net worth was about $5,000 at the age of 65. Mm-hmm. For those that did own their home, their net worth was closer to $150,000. And so the disparity is almost 14 to 20 times the difference of wealth at a retirement age if you own your home or you don't own your home. And so that's just a beginning start of, you know, what it takes for us to kind of help folks, both, you know, just folks in our state or both folks that are minorities. So this task force would be a good start to, it's one of those things you can't solve a problem if you don't know what the problem is or if you don't know that you do have a problem. The fact of the matter is that there are disparities in the amount of folks that are non-Hispanic white families. For example, in the state of Oregon, 67% of non-Hispanic white families own their homes, compared to close to 47% for maybe a Native American and or Alaskan Aleutians own. That's compared to those percentage of folks in the state own their homes. And it gets down to 37% for Hispanic families in our state and Native Americans. And so it's, to me, there is a disparity there, and so I think this task force would be very valuable in putting together some experts and some professionals to kind of go through and delve into some of the things that we want to investigate, which include identifying compiling data and identifying whether there are practices that are keeping our families from getting mortgages. Or is it more related to, you know, opportunities, the cost of housing, and maybe some opportunities similar to what the previous representative Brock Smith mentioned, you know, some programs which also are document recording fee program would allow some resources for these down payment assistant programs, including the home buyer savings account. So there's a lot of programs that we're working on right now that will help our families to both save, build the disciplines, and become homeowners, which I'd like to see a higher percentage of our community being homeowners in this state, because as we've seen, and I mentioned from a report from National Association of Realtors, that by the age of 65, retirement age, if you own a home, you have more opportunities. If you don't, your retirement situation is very bleak. So I look forward to your support with this bill and hopefully getting this task force established. And I think from there we can develop some programs and identify some weaknesses. So.
Okay, any questions for Representative Meek? Yes.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. Representative Meek, is there an end date for the task force?
December
19th.
I'm looking through.
Yes. Not sure if there's an actual end date. Is it in here?
December 31st, 2019.
Well done. Yeah. And it may have to be adjusted, but.
This is something that the governor could just, you know, designate and establish a task force without doing legislation. Have you approached the governor about doing something along those lines and just starting it sooner than later?
I have not, but I'd be happy to make that appointment. And, of course, anything that – well, it was one of those things, if you want something done, you got to do it yourself. So I think we
I'll
want
that.
To try to What's that?
I said, I'll tell her that.
Oh, okay, no, I'll not tell her. Yeah. But I think it starts with taking action first and then asking for help. So I definitely will go that route, too.
So, and I want to remind the committee, this is something that passed out of our committee last year with, I believe, bipartisan sponsorship and probably unanimous support. And it's one of the things that in a big session when tons of task forces are being sent to Ways and Means, some fall between the cracks. Not often because it's very expensive, but they just are worried about having too many task forces out there. So in a short session where there are a very limited number of things going, I think we're hoping that this has a better chance there. But I think that that's, Representative Stark, you have a good fallback position if it doesn't go that route. I do think it's a really important piece of what the state of Oregon needs to be focused on, looking at the disparity. So thank you very much for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah.
Again. I believe that we have finished with the member bills that people have told me about. Is there anyone here on this committee that would like to present anything else that you think may be coming to this committee? I will just mention one bill that that I have. You can keep your eyes and ears open for it, but I think it's going to, one of my personal bills is, I believe, going to the healthcare committee, but I'll mention it because I think there is a tie-in to this committee. It's to set up a maternal mortality and morbidity review committee at OHA. So you may be seeing in the news more recently, there's been a lot of attention on the fact that our maternal mortality rates have actually been going up while much of the rest of the world's maternal mortality rates are going down. And so there's a lot of concern about this. It's been on CNN. I had the Western representative for ACOG, which is the American College of OBGYNs, come to me about this last year. I think it was already well into the long session, and I couldn't take it on. But I've been actually working on it for a while with them, and then really it exploded this last fall. So the timing is good, I think, for us to look at it. 18 states have already set it up. CDC is really promoting it, saying this is very important that we look into what are the factors that are leading to this, and not just maternal mortality, but severe morbidity, people who almost die, because for every death, there's between 50 and 100 near deaths or severe complications that can be lifelong that come out of this. So there's very strong support from Oregon Medical Association, OHSU, Midwifery Council, variety of community-based organizations, public health, communities of color, who really embrace us taking this step. So you can't figure out how to solve things until you know what's causing it. So please keep your eyes and ears open for that, and if you're interested in signing on to it, we already have a commitment of bipartisan support on this, and we'd love to have your support as well. And I think, you know, given that social determinants of health, not just medical procedures, are significant factors, I think that's kind of the overlay with this particular committee. So that would be my piece. So we're going to move on to a summary of the committee bills that we're proposing. I am proposing that we introduce as committee bills. These are three bills, and I'm going to ask Cassie to give the summary of them. And at the end of each summary, I might add some comments. Layperson comments to summarize them. We have been discussing these both in the September hearings and the November hearings, and saying all along the intention is that we want to introduce these as committee bills. So I've tried to be very transparent within our framework of committee bills that these are ones that I want a lot of input into, and hope that our committee will embrace as three areas that we will be debating when the session opens. So I'm going to close the I'm going to keep the informational meeting open, and at the end of discussing these bills, then we will open up a work session for the purpose of introducing them as committee bills. So Cassie.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have three LCs for consideration to become committee measures. The first one is LC 38, dated January 10th, 2018, and this is the Municipal Bonding Constitutional Amendment. The LC proposes amending the Oregon Constitution by referral to voters, and the measure would allow municipalities such as counties, cities, or towns to use certain bonded indebtedness to finance capital costs of affordable housing. The LC specifies that the requirements of the measure refer to voters to describe affordable housing for the purposes above, and requires that the principal amount of indebtedness for a jurisdiction to not exceed 0.5% of the real market value of all property in the jurisdiction, We had informational hearings on this measure in both September and November to describe the background and hear from different stakeholders on that topic.
Why don't you go on and read the next one? Okay. It's so related.
LC 54 is dated January 9th, 2018, and is about the state bonding constitutional amendment. This would amend the Oregon Constitution by referral to voters and allows the state to incur general obligation indebtedness to finance costs associated with maintaining or increasing the availability of affordable housing. Within the LC, it specifies permissible actions for financing affordable housing projects, such as acquiring, improving, constructing, developing, remodeling, repairing, equipping, or furnishing real or personal property, planning for any of those activities, or issuing grants or loans to individuals, private entities, or municipalities. The legislative concept prohibits indebtedness if it would cause the total principal amount to exceed 1% of the real market value of property in the state. We also heard about this in September and November legislative days.
Okay, so I think Representative Meek just stepped out of the room, but Representative Meek and Representative Nierman have worked on a work group to really dig into these with stakeholders. So would you like to say anything about
the two? So I appreciate the work that the work group did there. One of the things that was kind of important to me is to put some safeguards on it, because we are monkeying with the Constitution, so we want to make sure we get it right, because we can't just come back and fix it. But one of the safeguards that isn't quite apparent in the first one. So the first one is to allow cities and counties to have their own kind of lift programs. And one of the safeguards that's built into that is that it's required that you put the definition of affordable housing in the ballot measure. And so it kind of means that you're going to have to think about it, and you're going to have to present it to the voters, and the voters are going to have to, one by one, approve or disapprove whatever projects that are proposed. So I think that part of it was important. The other one, we do or want to do a lot of bonding of affordable housing projects at the state, and so it seems appropriate that there's some sort of state authority to do that, and rather than piggybacking on housing for elderly or something that already exists in the Constitution, that this was to create a new section of bonding seemed appropriate. So that's what we're trying to do there.
Thank you. Representative Meek, would you like to add anything about the two constitutional measures that you worked on a work group with Representative Nierman on?
Well, no, thank you, Madam Chair. What I didn't catch everything, but I do agree exactly. I like the fact that part of the amendment would give authority for defining affordable housing to the communities that pass those measures. And so, I think this is a great tool. It's always difficult when we go into the Constitution and change it and getting voters to approve it, but I like the process that we went through. We had a lot of the industry agency leaders come through and speak with us and try to, you know, both the counties and municipalities and folks that would be affected by it. So we were, I loved the process and appreciated the input and, of course, our work. And I think that we came to a pretty good conclusion here, and hopefully we're able to get folks on board and get this through and allow for, when we're talking about housing again, this is one of those tools that's going to allow the government to both, you know, provide the funding but not necessarily do all the work, and because we know it's not necessarily the most efficient way to do this, and getting nonprofits involved, I think this is going to help leverage those funds and get us to a point that we can provide more affordable housing at a very economical price and value.
Thank you very much, and I'll just add that I think Representative Nierman's comments about making sure that we use the Constitution to safeguard, not let it get too out of hand, that's the purpose of the Constitution, is to put some safeguards in place so that whatever legislative assembly or municipal government is out there making decisions, there's some parameters. And so I think that I really appreciate both of you having a strong eye toward that. And at the same time, we don't want government to get in the way of the private sector, which we know needs to be a part of answering the affordable housing crisis. this is going to happen. This is not government-run programs to build housing. We can provide a little bit of the money into the mix to help build subsidized housing because it doesn't pencil out with some government money, but really it's the private sector that's building it. And we started out last year with a presentation that included somebody from Meyer Memorial Trust who had done a big project on cost drivers. We had that report on OLIS, and part of what they said is, you know, one of the ways you can bring down cost is make sure that whatever kind of bonding you have is flexible enough. And so I think that's the balance that we've tried to do, is make sure when it comes to the Constitution that we have the safeguards, but that we also don't let a government instrument get in the way of trying to solve some of our problems. And what we're looking at amending was created decades ago, not even for affordable housing purpose. So I think it's bringing it up to the kinds of things that we need now. I feel really confident that we've had a lot of both legalize and political philosophies and a whole variety of perspectives on this to kind of to create that right balance. So I appreciate that, you know, we've really worked this through over the last many months and had public hearings on it. And I'm excited about the product that we're bringing forward. Thank you very much to both of you in particular for working on this. The third one, why don't you read the summary on that?
The third LC is LC 85, dated January 9th, 2018. This LC is regarding the first-time home buyer savings account and document recording fee. So the LC does two things. First, it allows an individual to create a first-time home buyer savings account with a financial institution for the purpose of paying or reimbursing eligible costs to purchase a single-family residence up to a total of $50,000 during the 10-year period. The LC establishes limitations on subtractions and exemptions from taxable income and would be applicable to tax years beginning on or after January 2019 and before January 2025. The second piece of this LC increases the document recording fee for certain real property documents from $25 to $75 to be used for housing-related programs at the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. The LC also changes the income definition for the homeowner assistance account to income not more than 100% of the median family income and becomes effective on the 91st day following signee die. We heard information on this LC in November and from different stakeholders.
Thank you, Cassie, and I think it was, this may have been somewhat discussed in the September hearing. So I want to just say something about these two bills, and I'm just going to reverse the order of it and talk about the document recording fee piece of it first. As you may remember, there are only two dedicated ongoing sources of funding from the state to help local communities with affordable housing. One is the low-income housing tax credit that Representative Meek and Representative Noble worked on last year to continue for another 6 years, and we raised the cap on that from $17 million to $25 million on the number of dollars that can be out there at any time in loans. The other piece is the document recording fee, which was created in 2009 at $15, added $5 in 2013, I believe, when we said that 25% of that fee would go toward vets. And those are really the only two sources of funding, and we know we have a huge, huge crisis on our hands. The document recording fee revenue is split into three different buckets. 10% of it goes to emergency housing account to try to help distress renters keep up with rising rents or relocation or first time, first month or down payment assistance. And it can also be used for the state homeless assistance program, SHAP. So that's 10% of it. And it goes through the community action agencies all throughout the state in a formula that is devised by the Community Action Partnership of Oregon, which is a coalition of all of these groups. It's not OHCS that makes the decision. It's CAPO that comes up with this formula. It goes out to all of the different counties. Really, really critical, and we know that it nowhere near meets the need because they have to turn people away all the time who are distressed renters or who are homeless. Second Second bucket is home ownership, and that is 14% of it, and it goes out again in a formula, goes out to all the different counties to help with financial literacy and education programs, and then in a competitive process, people can also apply for down payment assistance. The third bucket is the 76% that goes to supply, and right now, not in statute, but by rule, 6% of that goes to capacity building, technical assistance, which is geared more toward rural areas to help them be competitive in this process, and 70% is for supply. And this goes through the GHAP program, General Housing Account Program. And this is what we hear from developers, affordable housing developers, and housing advocates throughout the state. This is the most flexible funds possible. It's that last little piece often that goes to help close a project after you've tried to put all of your financing, your traditional financing from banks, your low-income housing at the federal and at the state level, tax credits. This is the most flexible funds. And in fact, sometimes it's that last little piece, but in rural areas where there are very few financial partners at the table, it can actually even fund the entire thing. And so we had an example in November from Klamath Falls that had just opened its veterans housing that provided housing for 10 veterans. It was a cost of $2 million. It sounds like a lot up front, but this is going to go on and on and on. It's for veterans. It was a $2 million project, and it was fully covered by GHAP. There's another project that I'm hoping we'll hear from in February that just opened in Medford, similar kind of project for vets, fully funded by this GHAP, which is funded by the DOC fee, and that's for 17 units for veterans. So it's a very flexible program. One of the things that I've heard in the Housing Roadshow is that they would like to make sure that some of this capacity building that we've done is not only to help them put a proposal together to make it more competitive in the rural areas, but it can even back up further, go further upstream, and look at helping local cities and counties with how do you even assess what you need? How much housing do we need for veterans or domestic violence victims or families with homeless children? What are our needs, and how do we pull together, how do we find the land? How do we, you know, look at our zoning and ordinances so that we can even get to the stage of applying once there's a NOFA or a notice of funding available out there? So a lot of really these funds are being extremely well spent. The main thing about them is that there's nowhere near enough of them. And so the document recording fee does the document recording fee portion of this bill does three things. One is it raises the fee from the current $20 to $75. Many states have the real estate transfer tax that brings in a lot more money. We cannot do that because of a ban in the Constitution on that, but this would put the fee at $75. It would exempt county tax assessors who currently pay that fee when they do a property transfer on somebody who hasn't paid their property tax. They have to pay that fee right now, and it comes to approximately $300,000 a biennium, and so they will be exempted from this and no longer have to pay that fee. Originally, the Department of Revenue was exempted from it. The county tax assessors were not. It's kind of an oversight is what I hear, and we would save them that money by exempting them. The third thing it does is right now each of the three buckets, the emergency housing account and home ownership and supply, are all capped at serving people at 80% of median family income or below. And the home ownership piece, we've heard that's not enough. People who are up to 100% of median family income need to have access to that because the cost of housing has gone up so much more quickly than incomes. And so someone, particularly in rural areas where the wages tend to be less, are really, and yet the housing prices are still going up, they are having a particularly hard time. And so there will be more flexibility, particularly if we have more funds on the table, to be able to reach up to 100%. So that's the document recording fee part of it. The first-time home buyer tax deferral savings account program is something that the realtors bought forward last year, and we considered in this committee. We put a means testing on it and passed it out of this committee, I believe, with unanimous support. I think it had bipartisan co-sponsorship as well, and did not make it, because there'll be a fiscal cost to it, did not make it through the ways and means process. And so the realtors have continued working with the Affordable Housing Alliance, Affordable Housing Alliance, spearheaded by Allison McIntosh and Ryan Fisher, but represents a large group of stakeholders from around the state, have worked on both parts of this bill. But I just really want to call out the good collaboration that has gone into this with the realtors. I see Sean Gillian's in the audience. Really trying to get at what is the best policy and how can we best help people. And so this is really geared at home ownership. We are 47th in the country. We slipped from, we've slipped down to 47th in the country on home ownership. We were at one point 69% of Oregonians had home ownership. We are, I think, 62% now. I think the average in the country is something like 64%. We really want to do a concerted effort to change that. This portion of the bill that was presented last year was one of three different homeownership bills that went through this committee. None of them made it through Ways and Means. So we did not, other than a portion, the 20% of LIFT program going to homeownership, we didn't do anything specifically for homeownership in this last legislative session, in the previous session. So where this bill picks up from the doc fee, which is why I presented the doc fee first, so the doc fee helps homeowners currently at 80%. With this bill, it would go up to 100% with a down payment assistance. But with the home buyer savings account portion of it, that would stretch it out to up to 250% of median family income. So the full benefit of the tax deferral will be available to people up to 200%, individuals up to 200% of median family income, or am I saying it right, median family income or AMI? Area medium income, up to 200%, people who are making up to 200% of, if they're individuals, up to 200% of individuals, if they're couples, up to 200% of couples, would get the full tax deferral on their income tax returns, and it would then be phased down, so there's not a cliff, up to 250%. And so basically what this bill would do would put more money into the system for down payment assistance for people up to 100% of AMI, and then the home buyer savings account, tax deferral savings account, would pick up where that leaves off and allow people a tax deduction, a tax deferral, for up to between 200 and 250% of AMI. So I think these two pieces go together really well. I think we could make a huge dent in our home ownership rates by the combination of these two pieces. There will be changes that we've worked on, a lot of agreed upon changes, and a couple maybe that still need to be worked out. And we're going to be presenting that to you in an amendment. But there's been great collaboration on this bill. I'm really pleased with the people coming together who all want the right thing for Oregon. So, any questions on that before I close informational hearing and move to a work session? Okay, so I'm going to close informational hearing, meeting, and open a work session for the purpose of introducing the committee bills. And I want to just reiterate before Vice Chair Olson introduces these that when you vote on this, it doesn't mean that you are committing yourself to supporting any of these measures. Certainly you haven't seen the final version of at least the document recording fee and home buyer savings account. So no one by voting to introduce these is committing themselves to where they may land on this. All you are doing is voting on whether you agree that these are bills that should be heard and considered in this committee. So with that.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 38 dated 1-10-18, LC 54 dated 1-9-18, and LC 85 dated 1-9-18.
Okay, Vice Chair Olson moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 38 dated 1-10-18, LC 54 dated 1-9-18, LC 85 dated 1-9-18. I open it up for discussion. Representative Newman.
So just as a matter of process, I have an objection to just the existence of committee bills just because they're anonymous. I think that all legislation ought to be proposed by a named person who's accountable to voters. And so I'm going to vote no on the introduction of all of these, although I reserve the right to vote yes on any of them, I'm being laughed at by Representative Sanchez. I reserve the right to vote yes on them if they're good ideas, which I think there may be. So, and I also say that this doesn't reflect on you. I think you operate your committee in a very transparent way, and you're very transparent about the bills. So I appreciate that. So, but I will be voting no on the introduction of all three of these.
Thank you. Duly noted. I appreciate your continued call for transparency everywhere we can in the system. And thank you also for, I know we've talked about this, trying to be as transparent as possible all the way along, not springing things on people and being very clear where I stand on them. I would have been proud to put my name on any of these, and I think many of you would be too. This is the system that we have, and I try to use committee bills in a regular long session where we don't have the structure very sparingly, and usually try to call out why I might be doing that. But I appreciate your comments, and I think it's interesting if you might be voting yes to introduce them as committee bills without necessarily voting yes in the long run, and you might be voting no to introduce them and change your mind either way. So thank you for the explanation. Any other comments? Yes.
Thank you, Chair Kingeyer. And so is it accurate to say in the efforts for transparency that LC 38 and LC 54 were largely introduced from Representative Meek and Nierman? Or at least they discussed it, and LC 85 introduced by you. Is that reasonably accurate?
Would you guys say you were the work group
on that? Or?
I'll speak for myself. Is neither one of those LCs were my idea, so I wasn't the presenter of those. So,
You might not have been the chief sponsor, in other words, but maybe you would have signed on as a sponsor or raised a vote.
So it's not accurate to say that. Got it.
You know, because we knew there was a structure, we never went through the process of deciding whether this would necessarily be a personal bill. Certainly, I had a choice of whether I would put Representative Fahey's idea as a committee bill and take it on the doc fee as an individual bill. That could have been a choice, certainly. I had input from some of the stakeholders who were happy, including the realtors, to see this as a committee bill, and I was happy to oblige that because I felt that this is something that our committee has really been working on, and it perhaps takes it out of the partisan realm. So sometimes there's that feeling for wanting to go that direction, and I didn't have strong feelings about it. I think I aired it several times. This is what we're considering, committee bill. If there had been huge objections, I would have been proud to take it on as a personal bill. Okay, so with that, if there's no more discussion, any objections to voting on this? All right. Yeah.
I'm objecting.
Okay, so one abstention. Given that there one objection, I think let's go ahead and do a roll call, just because it's a
Representative
unanimous.
Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Meek?
Aye.
Representative Nierman?
No.
Representative
Noble.
Aye.
Representative Peluso.
Aye.
Representative Stark.
Yes.
Vice Chair Olson.
See.
Vice Chair.
Are you picking
aye?
Letter C?
Okay, so all three of those are introduced as committee bills. I'm going to close the work session, and I'm going to reopen the informational meeting for the purpose of one last agenda item, presentation from Children First of Oregon.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, and members of the committee for this little bit of time just to talk about this coming session. Children First for Oregon has been around for 25 years, and my name is James Barta. I'm the strategic director for Children First for Oregon. And Children First has been around for 25 years. We're best known for our county data book, but in our efforts to live up to our mission of empowering communities to advocate for kids so all children can thrive, we work with many different advocates in addition to the members of this committee. And in the last 4 years, we've created United for Kids, which now has 100-plus partners. And I'm happy to say that the latest partner we've added is FACT Oregon, and we're looking forward to working with them on disability issues for children. And partners can submit concepts. And so this is our fourth year that we will have a children's agenda. Last one this past year. I hope everyone has at least some familiarity with it. 56 items in that last one. Fortunately for a short session, our partners have submitted and through our process approved 17 concepts. And typically, a lot of them come through this committee. And certainly a lot of the subjects that we are discussing in this children's agenda are topics that this committee is familiar with. But through interesting circumstances, of these 17, actually only a couple will probably be coming through this committee. I just want to mention briefly some of the ones that are not. There are, you know, the paid family leave, which has been a big point of discussion that will continue to be, the clean energy jobs will be. But there, Representative Sanchez has an idea that deals with foster youth that I understand will be going through Judiciary Committee. But just wanted to, you know, that's the plan. We'll see what the Speaker's office decides. And there'll be various early learning programs. I do want to flag one in particular because new in our process is we are prioritizing issues. And one of those is the need for culturally specific early learning programs. We have successful programs out there that are targeted for different ethnic communities that are presented by those same communities. And it's, we believe, in the state's interest to explore a funding process for those. Now, like I said, there's numerous other programs and ideas, but that leaves just three that are of direct interest to this committee. One, of course, is the aforementioned document recording fee. We'll probably have numerous partners, probably over a dozen at least, that will be supporting some form of document recording fee because of the importance of funding affordable housing for children, and as described already. Also, Representative Peluso has the update TANF idea that we've been happy to work with her on. It's just been too long since TANF has been updated in terms of the cash grant, in terms of much of the program, and many of you are on a work group that the Speaker's office has set up, and we look forward to observing and working with you on that, but that's beyond this session. And finally, the other priority item that is not directly in this committee, but is an issue, it's a budget issue, but it's one that this committee should be aware of, is, as you know, employment-related daycare experienced cuts in this past session through, you know, due to various reasons. But this is a program that, in my experience, business interests, education interests, lots of different groups know the importance. Not only do children need quality health care, it improves their outcomes later in life, but the parents need a steady child care so they can go back to work. They need to advance their careers. Right. And without a safe, adequate, good supply of child care, that simply isn't going to happen. We're losing not only a generation of children, but a generation of adults who aren't able to find steady work because whatever child care they have set up is simply not available. And they can't keep a steady job then. It seems like an easy subject that I'm surprised at the amount of agreement that we are finding among our partners. So I'd be happy to talk more about our process, but I'm very happy to work with the members of this committee to advance these goals for Oregon's children.
Great. Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. James, the employment-related daycare is, as you said, a very substantial problem. And I think in my first term, we worked on trying to get child care reestablished to community colleges, which was not successful. And sadly, one of the ideas was, well, ERDC could take care of some of that. Obviously, it's not. And so I would just add that I think we also need to have the community college piece in there too as a focus, because I have a lot of students at our college at Mount Hood who they have substantial problems trying to afford
care for their children while they're going to school. And one of the frustrations can be that we have a very nice child care facility, but they don't qualify. So Head Start is there, and I've even had students say, well, I'll pay them anything that they want so I can get my kids in there so I can go to school. But it's not how it works. And so I just hope that we can keep that sort of education care idea in there as well.
Chair Kenigaya, Representative Gorsuch. I'm in conversations. There's a national group that will be having a conference this summer on college students who are also parents. You know, how do we find child care for them? So I'll be happy to discuss that with you further.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, James. Related to employment-related daycare, I have anecdotal, you know, experience with having folks that I know, young parent that was working really hard and was on the employment-related daycare program and got a raise. And unfortunately, the raise didn't cover the when they went and renewed and had to review their application with ERDC. They said, well, you're making more money now, and they raised the amount that they had to pay to ERDC, $500 a month. They got a 50-cent an hour raise. Mm-hmm. So I think this program needs to be looked at, and so that we don't have a cliff that suddenly you're making a little extra money. You're starting to make gains, but you're going backwards. Because what happens, and I've had other folks and business owners that I know of have tried to hire really good people, and they get them, and they come in and say, I'm sorry, I can't work for you anymore because I'm going to lose my daycare. And so we are disincentivizing. It's a kind of a double-edged sword. We're getting people to work initially, and they start having success, but they can't sustain enough success to remain working because they lose their daycare. And it's the daycare is so important, and I think that is one of the roadblocks to getting our young families to work and into the workforce and sustaining, you know, and getting their careers going. And so I would look forward to working together with this committee and this legislative assembly to do more investment in that employment-related daycare, because we want folks to get off of their, you know, entitlements, but we need to give them a path and a really good, successful path to achieve success. So thank you for your work on that.
If I could add, Representative Kenny here, that, yeah, it's an odd program in that it doesn't have a traditional cliff where you make enough money and suddenly you don't get the benefit anymore. What happens is your copay goes up so much that these working parents, they might as well drop out of the program. It doesn't make any sense for them to continue on.
Well, there is a cliff, but that gives you through the end of the year. So we, when we did some changes a couple of years ago, and I know Representative Stark worked on this a lot, we said that the program had always been available to people up to 185% of, I think, federal poverty limit. And so we had this problem where people had a disincentive because they didn't want to lose it. So we actually said you can come in at 185, you have to leave at 250%. So there is an end date, but not in the middle of the year, because you don't want to take your kids out in the middle of the year. So we have a much softer landing to it, but I'm not sure that we looked as carefully at what the copay is. So you may still be able to be on it, but your copay may, the amount of increased copay, because it is a sliding scale, sounds like it far exceeds what the increase. So sounds like we need to deal with the other half of that equation. Representative Stark, do you remember all these discussions? You dug into the numbers.
Yep.
Any comments from you?
Nope.
And Representative Hayden has had a big voice in this, too, to ensure that rural areas are not treated separately, because the copayment amount is based on average wages in, I think, three different regions, which means that they end up basing their average a lot lower, and so the copay that they have to pay is higher. The amount of benefit that they get is lower based on that, and that is something that the task force is, I think, right now looking at as well.
The subsidy, Chair Kenigaya, depends on the region and the type of care and the age of the child. The copay simply depends on the number of people in the household and their income. And so the 12-month eligibility is really important, so when someone gets that raise, they can continue on care. But once their new income is once their income is registered, though, that copay can go up. When if you're at the high end of eligibility, at near 250% of income, it's close to 30% of your income is your copay, which, you know, is. You know, who's going
like
to afford that?
Limit the copay to no more than the, your increase in salary at
yeah,
most,
right.
something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right, right. Some kind of graduate it somehow.
So, and due to the budget cuts from this past session, the wait list has been restarted. And in the first 4 weeks of the wait list, more than 260 families signed on and were eligible, otherwise eligible, but unable to received the subsidy, and that was, like I said, in the first 4 weeks, and that was November 1st, and now we're in mid-January. I don't have the latest numbers, but I suspect, you know, there's now 500-some families that otherwise could have a steady job and the children receiving quality child care. But as one last comment about the agenda itself is just keep in mind that, you know, we have more than 100 partners. Not all agree with everything on the agenda, but we're working to find common ground between children's advocates, to make your job easier, I hope, and to iron out any differences they might have, and to find common ground with all of you, because we all know that it's important for Oregon's children to get all the opportunities they can.
Okay. Any further questions? No. Thank you so much. All right. Before we close, I want to say for the record that I skipped when I said the state had only two, continuing dedicated sources of funding. I forgot the general fund for emergency housing assistance, EHA, and SHAP, which is traditionally in the past been $10 million a biennium. And in 2016, we upped it so that biennium came to a total of $20 million. This last biennium, we upped it again because of the emergency. It became $40 million. The problem with that is it's one-time funding, and so it's really hard for shelter systems across the state. If they don't know that the funding is going to be there, they can't acquire funding and outfit it with beds and tell staff that they'll be there more than a year and a half. But I neglected to say that third source of ongoing support. I haven't had all my coffee this morning, but in any case, that's the low-income housing fund tax credit, the emergency housing and SHAP continuing service level out of the general fund, and the doc fee are our three statewide sources of ongoing support. Okay, any other questions before we close? Got a little extra time in your agenda. All right, close the hearing.